It's time now to go to the lymphatic system and body defenses. That's the name of the chapter. And the name of that chapter actually brings up an important point right away. That is that we sometimes use the phrase immune system, but despite the name having system in it, there is no official organ system called the immune system. Instead, the immune system is used to describe a system of structures and processes that protect us, that give us immunity, in other words. The lymphatic system has an important role in the immune system, or in immunity, which is a less confusing term. But what we call the immune system is not only not an organ system, it's not one of the 11 organ systems, it involves structures that are spread out among several different organ systems, not just the lymphatic system, but digestive system and other systems as well. So, as far as organ systems are concerned, we're talking in this chapter about the lymphatic system, but another major focus of this chapter is just immunity, protecting the body. And so, in the opening slide, we can see one of the major reasons why we need the lymphatic system. The lymphatic system, by the way, is probably the most forgotten organ system. If you were to just randomly poll people on the streets, they would be able to come up with most of the 11 organ systems, probably. But a lot of people, I don't think, even realize that we have a lymphatic system. Everyone knows that we have a circulatory system. Everyone knows that we have blood vessels. But there's probably a lot of people out there who don't even realize that we have a separate set of vessels running alongside our blood vessels, making up what we call lymphatic vessels. And we see this illustrated in this opening slide. The red and the blue obviously represent blood vessels. And notice that we call that system the circulatory system because it actually circulates, meaning that there is no beginning or end. It goes around and around several times. I mean, unlimited number of times. It's a closed loop, in other words. That's not true for the vessels making up the lymphatic system. The lymphatic vessels have a beginning, or several different beginnings, really. They are blind-ended vessels that represent the start in terms of the flow of materials. And the material that is picked up by these lymphatic vessels is called lymph. It's fluid that runs through these lymphatic vessels throughout the body, but then eventually dumps into the circulatory system. So lymph does not circulate. Lymph has a beginning and an ending in terms of how it travels. Blood, on the other hand, circulates. But what is lymph? Well, lymph is fluid that leaks out of the circulatory system. So lymph is part of blood originally, and this one capillary bed down on the bottom of the slide really represents all the capillary beds. There are thousands and thousands of capillary beds throughout the body, the various tissues. This is where the cells of the various body tissues take up the oxygen that the blood is delivering, and then they dump off the CO2. That's just one or two of the major things that blood is carrying. But anyway, this represents all the capillaries of the body, not just one place. And capillaries are important for not only exchanging oxygen and carbon dioxide, there's other things carried by the blood that reach the capillaries, including hormones, for instance. And whereas oxygen and carbon dioxide can just diffuse right through the epithelial lining of the blood cells, they do this because they are nonpolar molecules. They They're small and they're nonpolar, so they can go right through the phospholipid bilayer of cells. They can't be locked inside the bloodstream, in other words. But other things, like hormones, would be locked in the bloodstream if it weren't for the fact that blood capillaries are leaky. They have to be leaky, in other words, for things like hormones to exit the bloodstream and be able to reach their target tissues where they can bind to a receptor, like we were talking about in the last chapter. So, even though we call it a closed circulatory system, it's not perfectly closed. It can't be, because things need to leak out of the blood capillaries. Well, there's a lot of leakage of fluid in general, not all of which should actually be leaving the bloodstream. It just, because it has to be leaky for other things to get out, that means some unwanted things are continuously leaving the bloodstream. And that fluid that's lost from the bloodstream at the leaky capillaries is what we call lymph. And so lymph, as it exits the bloodstream, is really just added to the extracellular fluid. It's outside of cells. It's occurring between the cells of the body. And it would build up. And sometimes in abnormal situations, it does build up, resulting in what we call edema or swelling. And that can be really dangerous. Well, this is a major reason why we need a lymphatic system. Because if it weren't for the lymphatic vessels, whose job it is to pick up that lymph that has leaked out of the bloodstream, edema would kill us pretty quickly. We would just lose too much fluid from the blood, it wouldn't get returned to the blood, and the swelling would kill us. So that's a major function of the lymphatic system. These blind-ended lymphatic capillaries, the smallest of the lymphatic vessels, pick up the fluid that's lost from the bloodstream, and then that lymph travels through lymphatic vessels. They get bigger and bigger, just like tributaries of a river. You know, two tributaries of a river come together to form a bigger river, and so on, until you have finally a huge river like the Mississippi that dumps into the ocean. Well, for the lymphatic system, you have eventually huge, what are called ducts, lymphatic ducts or lymph ducts, that connect directly to major veins in the body. And this happens in the shoulder. We'll look at that in a minute. But that lymph that started out as leaking out from the blood is eventually returned directly to the bloodstream. And that's why, under normal situations, you don't have edema, because at the same rate that liquid is being leaked out of the blood, that liquid is being returned to the bloodstream. Along the way, there are structures called lymph nodes, and they are not really so much about returning the fluid. They just happen to be in this roadway. The lymph nodes are about the other major function of the lymphatic system, which is to protect us. They function for immunity, in other words. Let's go on to slide 2 and look at a close-up here of just a single capillary bed. This doesn't matter where this is. This is somewhere in the body. But you have small blood vessels called arterioles that branch into even smaller blood vessels called capillaries. And the red capillary here is carrying oxygenated blood that it gets oxygenated at the lungs, but now it's being delivered somewhere to the body. And notice that there's a gradual change from red to blue. The other end of this capillary bed is made up of capillaries that are carrying deoxygenated blood. Well, the blood becomes deoxygenated because the cells in this area take up the oxygen by diffusion from the blood, and therefore when that oxygen that's being carried by the hemoglobin in the blood gets removed, that turns the color of hemoglobin from reddish to bluish. But anyway, these This deoxygenated blood then collects into a small venule, small vein, that makes it, that delivers blood through bigger and bigger veins, eventually back to the heart for another trip to the lungs. But that's the circulatory system itself. Notice the green vessels, though. These green vessels are blind-ended. I used that term earlier, meaning they don't have, they're not in a closed loop. They just form blind ends, and that those represent the starting point in terms of the flow of this fluid, this lymph. But they are vessels just like capillaries are, which means that they're hollow, they're tubes, and the fluid that leaks out of the capillaries makes its way into these lymphatic capillaries. And then as more and more lymph comes in, it pushes the lymph downstream. And notice that the capillaries join as tributaries to form larger and larger lymphatic vessels. And eventually, like we saw on the previous slide, huge lymphatic vessels will dump all of this reclaimed liquid from the blood back into the bloodstream. Now on to three. This is an extreme close-up of just one of those blind ends of a lymphatic capillary. And so notice the structure here. You have cells that are making up the epithelium that make up the wall of the vessel, but they're arranged in a special way. Notice that they overlap kind of like shingles on a roof. And they overlap in such a way that they work like flap valves. And this allows for fluid as it accumulates in here, when after it's been spilled out of the bloodstream, it accumulates as extracellular fluid around here. That, once that accumulation builds up, it will force liquid into here. But it will, since it's a flap, it will preferentially move inward, but not outward. And as more and more comes in, it will push it along the way. Now, associated with these cells are filaments, as you see here, connective tissue filaments, that anchor these lymphatic capillaries to the surrounding tissue. This is important because these vessels are blind-ended. Therefore, there's nothing, unlike blood vessels that are in a circuit, if they get pulled, you can't really pull them out of place. Here, if something pulled on this, it would be dragged to some other part of the body and it would never be able to come back here. So these filaments keep them in place since they're blind-ended. Now on the map of the body in slide 4, we see two major colors here, the greenish and the reddish. And this illustrates that the even though all of the fluid that's collected by the lymphatic vessels get delivered eventually back into the bloodstream at the shoulders, like I was saying, it's not a symmetrical arrangement. Notice that there is basically a quarter of the body that gets drained into one side. That this is, notice, the right side. Remember, it's his right. The right side that delivers through a lymphatic duct into the right subclavian vein. These are called subclavian veins. Subclavian means below the clavicle. The clavicle will be right here if you saw the bones. And so these major veins in the shoulders are called subclavian veins. Well, the right the thoracic duct empties into the right subclavian vein, but it drains lymph from only this upper right region of the body. Everything else, which is basically 3/4 of the body, gets drained and eventually dumped into the left thoracic duct, or left lymphatic duct, which gets the special name thoracic duct. And so that's the biggest of all the lymphatic vessels. You can see the end of it right there. That drains most of the body of lymph and puts it back into the bloodstream for another trip around. And so, you know, it gets put back into the bloodstream, but it's going to leak again. And so it's going to start out in lymphatic capillaries again after it leaks and then get returned once again. Now, all the little green spheres here are lymph nodes, and there are hundreds of lymph nodes, probably between 400 and 500 throughout the body. They're mostly about the same size, but there are some that are even bigger. And sometimes you have them clustered in different parts of the body, like you see here. These are axillary nodes. The axillary means of the axilla, which is the armpit. So these are called that because of their position. The inguinal nodes are located in the inguinal region and so on. But of the hundreds of lymph nodes, they are like little stops along the highway. The highway itself being the lymphatic vessels, the connection, the network of lymphatic vessels is like a highway system. And these lymph nodes are not like rest stops along the highway, because you'd have to exit to get to them. They are right in the middle of the road, meaning that lymph has to flow through these nodes to go along its way eventually to make it into the subclavian veins back into the bloodstream. And that's why these lymph nodes are placed there. It guarantees that stuff that's carried in that lymph gets exposed to the contents of these lymph nodes. And there are specialized cells in these lymph nodes that we'll look at that are responsible for surveilling that liquid, or that fluid, that lymph, for invading microorganisms and other things that could do you harm. So that's why I said earlier that lymph nodes' job is to function for immunity, not really just about returning the lymph to the bloodstream. Well, let's look at a close-up. This is just a single lymph node, one of the hundreds that are spread out through the body. And one thing that you notice here is that there are more inputs into the node than there are outputs. The vessels that bring lymph into the lymph node, notice, are called afferent vessels. Afferent, we already just described these words before in the nervous system. Remember that afferent and efferent mean incoming and outgoing. That's why we called sensory neurons afferent, because that's bringing information into the central nervous system. And we called motor neurons efferent, because that's carrying information out of the central nervous system. Well, here, it's not information, it's fluid that we're talking about. And so lymph enters a lymph node through afferent lymphatic vessels and then leaves the lymph node through efferent lymphatic vessels. The reason that there are fewer efferent vessels than there are afferent vessels is because as this lymph makes its way back toward the bloodstream through those subclavian veins, smaller and smaller vessels are joining into bigger and bigger vessels, like tributaries of a river. So these are like several small creeks, and these are larger rivers or streams. So the reason that there are fewer efferents is because they are bigger. So they're carrying the same amount of fluid as is coming in, but they're able to carry it with fewer vessels because the diameter of the efferent vessels is bigger than the diameter of the afferent vessels. And inside this is a cutaway view of the lymph node. Well, first of all, before we get to the inside, notice that the whole lymph node is enclosed with a capsule, a fibrous connective tissue capsule that really just maintains the integrity of it. It holds everything in. But then there, coming from that capsule, are several different wall-like structures, but they're not entire walls. Otherwise, it would close it off entirely. Well, these basically just subdivide the lymph node into little chambers, although they're not complete chambers. Otherwise, the fluid wouldn't flow through it. But within these chambers, which are called follicles, the overall interior of it, notice, is called the cortex. As we've talked about before, there's a medulla and there's a cortex. cortex is the superficial interior, and then the medulla is deeper in here. But a follicle is one of these little chambers, one of these centers of one of these little chambers, and in those follicles is where you find various kinds of white blood cells that we'll talk about in a different slide. These white blood cells, unlike the red blood cells, are operating for immunity. There's two major categories of blood cells, red blood cells or erythrocytes, and white blood cells or leukocytes. Well, within one human, all the erythrocytes are the same. Their job is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. They don't operate for immunity. But the other category, the leukocytes or white blood cells, there are five major categories of them, and we'll look at those categories later in this chapter. But their job has nothing to do with carrying oxygen or carbon dioxide. Their job is for immunity. So the white blood cells, like all blood cells, start out in marrow in the skeleton, but they eventually make their way to lymph nodes. A lot of them do. Some of them stay in the bloodstream. And the ones that are in the lymph nodes are there at the ready, waiting for any bacteria or any other pathogens that might be in the lymph and that could therefore hurt you. They get dealt with in lymph nodes. They get killed in lymph nodes, hopefully. The hilum, by the way, that's just the name for this little indentation, which is where the efferent vessels are located. This has kind of the same shape as a kidney, because when you look at a kidney, it also has this indentation in it, and that's also called a hilum. That would be the renal hilum for a kidney. Here it's a lymph nodes hilum. Now on to slide 6. This is an overall view of some important structures making up the lymphatic system other than the lymphatic vessels that we've already looked at. There are tonsils, and there are three major pairs of tonsils that you see here, but they are located in the pharyngeal region. The pharyngeal is just the adjective of pharynx, and the pharynx is the throat. So it's a common passageway for air, food, and drink. It's kind of like a hallway in a sense, because the food and drink go down the hallway and through a door to a certain single passage, which is the esophagus, to make its way to the stomach. And air goes through that same pharynx, but exits that hallway through a different door to go through the trachea to get to the lungs. In this pharyngeal region, though, there are these tonsils arranged. And tonsils include lymphatic tissue that is rich in these protective cells, these white blood cells that can protect you from invaders. That's why they're located where they are, because the mouth is a major opening that is a potential threat. I mean, it's a potential place where threatening pathogens could enter your body, and they do enter, but hopefully the tonsils can keep most of the bad stuff out. That's why they're located there. Now, the thymus is located between the two lungs, as you see here, in a region that I hope you remember. The middle region, the median region of the thorax, is called the mediastinum, and that includes not only the heart and a bunch of plumbing with the esophagus and the trachea, and but it includes the thymus as well. And the thymus, notice it says most active during youth. That's when it is much bigger. So in a baby, it makes up a very big fraction of the thorax, actually. And then it gets smaller and smaller as we age. And in an old person, it might even be hard to find it. It's so small. Here it's already been decreased in size quite a bit, because this is someone who's at about adulthood. This makes sense, because the job of the thymus is to have special white blood cells called T lymphocytes mature so that they can do their job. And that's what the T of T lymphocyte stands for. It stands for thymus. They're not created in the thymus. All blood cells start out in the marrow, but the cells that are destined to become T cells, as we sometimes call them, or T lymphocytes, they make their way to the thymus first and spend some time there developing, maturing into active versions of T lymphocytes that can actually protect you. And that's most important in a young person, especially a baby, because they haven't been exposed to much stuff yet. And therefore, they need to go through a period of producing a lot of different kinds of T lymphocytes to protect them against the various things they're being exposed to. The official boundary between the thorax and the abdomen is the diaphragm, which would be right about here, connected to the inferior aspect of the lungs. So that's where thorax ends and abdomen begins. And tucked up in the extreme upper left corner of the abdomen, you find the spleen next to the stomach. This is the stomach. The spleen is labeled here, as you see. And the spleen is not only a member of the lymphatic system, it's a lymphatic organ, but it is connected to a lot of blood vessels. And that makes sense because the major job of the spleen is to filter out old, either dead or no longer working red blood cells or erythrocytes. Red blood cells don't live very long in the body, only a couple weeks, because, for one thing, they don't have a nucleus. They start out having a nucleus like a normal cell does, but they lose that nucleus as they develop into mature red blood cells, because by losing the nucleus, that makes more room in the cell, which is really specialized for packing as many hemoglobin molecules into that red blood cell as possible, so they can carry as much oxygen as possible. But without a nucleus, there's no DNA, and they therefore don't have the ability to make proteins and repair themselves. Not only that, but they, speaking of repair, they really go through a lot of abuse because they're forced through these blood capillaries over and over, repeatedly. Every time it goes around the body and gets to a capillary bed, the red blood cells get squeezed through capillaries, which are so small in diameter, they're even smaller diameter than the red blood cells themselves. So that means red blood cells squeeze through capillaries in single file, and that puts a lot of wear and tear on them. So they wear out pretty quickly, and that's why you make billions of them every day to replace billions of them that you lose every day. And where you lose them, other than bleeding, if you're bleeding, you lose them by having the spleen filter out those ones that have seen better days, and then they get broken down into the raw materials, which can then be recycled to make new hemoglobin, for instance. But that's part of the lymphatic system. Scattered here and there on the intestines are things that are similar to tonsils as far as the tissue that makes them up. It's made up of lymphatic tissues or lymphoid tissue. They are called Peyer's passages, though. And that also makes sense where they're located, just like locating them around the pharynx, which is a major potential inroads into the body for pathogens. Also, the intestines are a major way that things could get into your body, because that's where the nutrients that are in food finally make it into your body, right? Remember that the interior of the alimentary canal is really outside of your body. You're wrapped around that tube. So you take in a bunch of bacteria whenever you eat. A lot of them get killed by the stomach because they can't tolerate the high acidity or low pH. But some of them could make their way in if they survive. They could make their way into your body where the nutrients get absorbed. And that's why the Peyer's patches are scattered throughout the small intestine. And you also have the appendix, which is located on the cecum. This part of the large intestine is called the cecum, C-E-C-U-M. Which means pouch. Well, the appendix gets its name because it is added on or appended to the cecum. It's sometimes called, the full name is the vermiform appendix, V-E-R-M-I-F-O-R-M, means worm-like, shaped like a worm is vermiform. You can see it's shaped like a worm. And this is something that that a lot of people have, or not so much nowadays, but a lot of people got these decades ago removed pretty routinely. And they still are removed, of course, if they get inflamed, because otherwise it can kill you. But the appendix is not necessary for you to live, and therefore it's sometimes described as a vestigial organ, because it might be, evolutionarily speaking, it might be on its way out. We might be, you know, each successive generation probably has a more and more worthless appendix until eventually you, if we survive thousands of years into the future, which we probably won't, we'll probably go extinct as a species. But anyway, the appendix might be on its way out evolutionarily. Let's go on to 7. Now, this table is about the immune function. Notice, as I've said before, there's no organ system called the immune system. The immune system here just refers to the things that happen in your body to give you immunity or protect you from invaders. And notice by the arrangement of this table that there are two major categories of defense mechanisms. Those are called innate and adaptive. They both protect you, but they do so in different ways. Notice that innate is also called nonspecific, and adaptive is also called specific. Well, this word innate includes the N-A-T root, like in natal or nativity. That means, the N-A-T root means birth. So natal means at birth, which is why someone who's premature is called neonatal. Before the, or just if not even a premature birth, or just when you get neonatal care, that means it's before birth. The fetus hasn't been born yet. Or nativity refers to the birth of someone. Well, innate means inborn, therefore, meaning that you're born with this, with these defense mechanisms. And the reason it's called nonspecific is because the innate defense mechanisms that you're born with operate the same way throughout the life. They do things the same way, and it doesn't depend at all on what kind of thing could be doing potential harm to you. It doesn't matter what the pathogen is. The defense mechanisms work the same way all the time. They don't adapt, in other words. On the other hand, the adaptive defense mechanisms do adapt. They adjust depending on what is happening in your life. So that's why they're called specific. As you get exposed to things, your body builds up defense mechanisms that are specific to that kind of pathogen or dangerous particle. And therefore, but the adaptive mechanisms learn by your experience in life, the things that you get exposed to. And so as you live your life, you accumulate more and more adaptive defense mechanisms to protect you against more and more things. This is why, by the way, why kids tend to get sick so often. They don't have as many adaptive defense mechanisms build up like adults do. Okay, well then, notice in the table that the innate defense mechanisms are broken into two categories, or so-called lines of defense. There's three lines of defense overall, first, second, and third line of defense, as you see, but the first and second lines of defense make up the innate or nonspecific defense mechanisms that you were born with. The first line of defense is called that simply because that's the first things that work, right there on the exterior of your body, where you're in direct contact with the rest of the world, including the things that could hurt you. So an important part of the first line of defense is the skin itself. And we've talked about this already in the integumentary system chapter. The skin is a barrier between you and the rest of the universe, basically. So a lot of things just cannot get through the skin, and it therefore forms a first line of defense. The mucous membranes are also really a part of your body's covering, but they are not dry like the skin is, or mostly dry like the skin is. They are mucus. I think I talked about this word before. There's two different words that are pronounced exactly the same. Mucus, M-U-C-O-U-S, and mucus, M-U-C-U-S. Mucus is a noun. That is the stuff that you know as mucus, the sticky, thick stuff. Well, the adjective that means having to do with mucus is mucous. So membranes that produce mucus, mucus, are called mucous membranes, mucous. And the skin doesn't produce mucus, but the other parts that are really outside of your body, like the lining of the vagina, the lining of the throat, that's just as much outside of your body as your skin is, notice, because the outside air is exposed to those things if you open up the holes that lead to those mucous membranes. So they produce mucus as a way of protecting you. Mucus is also a lubricant, so things can slide through those openings more easily. That's why the entire alimentary canal from mouth to anus is made up of mucous membranes. It lubricates the stuff you swallow, for one thing. But another function of mucus, because of its stickiness, is that it's microorganisms and debris particles that are from the exterior, and some of which might hurt you, can stick to that mucus and give the cells of your body, your defensive cells, a chance to deal with them correctly. The skin is not only a barrier, though. The skin does produce various secretions, and we talked about those in the integumentary system chapter, that make it even better first line of defense. There's the so-called acid mantle, slightly acidic secretions from the skin that make it harder for things to live on your skin. And if they can't live on the surface of the skin, they're going to die before they get a chance to get into your body. The second line of defense is also innate. You're born with it. But it includes specialized kinds of cells, as you see here, among other things. Phagocytic cells are cells that undergo phagocytosis. That's what this is just the adjective of phagocytosis. And phagocytic cells are cells that just surveil the body, looking for things that shouldn't be there. And when they find things that shouldn't be there, they just engulf them. That's what phagocytosis is, remember. And when they swallow them, they end up dismantling those things and therefore rendering them harmless. Natural killer cells are cells that find bacteria, which of course are not your own cells. They recognize them as foreigners, but bacterial cells will be attacked by these natural killer cells. That's not actually specifically true. Natural killer cells are cells of your body that recognize your own cells that have been invaded, either that or that are cancerous. So when your own cells become problematic by either being invaded or by being cancerous, then natural killer cells, which are also your cells, will kill those abnormal cells, keeping them from turning into a problem. So, you know, when we say someone has cancer, it's already gotten well beyond the stage. Really, there are cells that are turning cancerous in your body all the time, but usually the natural killer cells will recognize that and they'll kill them so before they can reproduce and get the cancer out of control. There are also various antimicrobial proteins that are proteins produced by the normal cells of your body that in one way or another don't allow these unicellular organisms to get a foothold in your body. They're antimicrobial, just like chemicals that you can use in soap that are antimicrobial. You also have something that's called the inflammatory response, which is a very complex set of occurrences, actually, that protect you from invasion of pathogens. For instance, if you suffer a cut and you don't wash it very well, especially, it will become inflamed. That's inflammatory response. And there are various things like heat and pain and redness that result. Those things protect you. We'll talk about the inflammatory response a little bit later. Fever is elevated body temperature. And fever, we use it as a sign that something is going wrong in your body, but fever is an adaptive response Don't confuse it with this adaptive up here. I just mean it's adaptive because it helps you. It evolved in us because it helps us. The elevated body temperature that fever brings about not only speeds up reactions in your body that could help protect you, because things happen faster at a higher temperature, but also the elevated body temperature makes certain pathogens that are invading you harder to live. They can't tolerate the high heat, so it makes them less likely that they will live or reproduce to make even more pathogens in your body. So that is innate. You're born with that, and it's non-specific. It always happens the same way. The adaptive defense mechanisms, though, you accumulate throughout your lifetime, and they make up the third line of defense. And the major cell types that are responsible for learning and for this specific or adaptive defense mechanisms are the lymphocytes, and there are different kinds of lymphocytes. There are antibodies, which are not cells. These are molecules, but they're produced by lymphocytes, as we'll see. Antibodies are proteins, and they're proteins that have just the right shape at one end of them to recognize certain things that are foreign in your body. So antibodies are about your own cells recognizing things that are in your body that should not be there. And this is why this is a specific defense mechanism. Your body just randomly makes antibodies whether you're exposed to anything or not. But if you are exposed to something that you happen to already have an antibody shaped just right for, then that will tell the body, make a bunch of copies of this particular antibody, because we'll need these to defend against this thing that just came into the body. This is exactly how vaccines work, and we'll talk more about antibodies in a different part of the slideshow as well. But then there are also macrophages. Macro means big, but phage means eat. So macrophages are specialized white blood cells that are also phagocytic, but they are a different kind. They operate differently from these phagocytic cells that are part of the second line of defense. Macrophages and other cells are antigen-presenting cells. Well, this word antigen refers to anything that can be recognized in the body by antibodies as being foreign material. So the things that antibodies, which are proteins, recognize are collectively called antigens. Antigens are foreign material. Antibodies are what you make to recognize antigen. And there are cells called antigen-presenting cells because when they engulf whatever the foreign thing is, like a bacterium, for instance, they will break that bacterium into pieces so it can't do you harm, but then those pieces will be put into the surface of that cell that just engulfed the bacterium so that the antibodies of the body can see these antigens that are sticking out from the surface. In other words, it neutralizes the threat, but then advertises the pieces of that threat as antigens that the immune system can recognize via antibodies. All right, now to eight. This is a several slides long table. Notice it goes slide 8, 9, 10. So we'll look at it in three slides. But notice how it's broken down. This is looking at the first line of defense in this first slide, the first part of the table. We've already talked about a lot of this, and I'm not going to read every little word to you. But the epidermis, which is the superficial part of the skin, as you recall, that is an important mechanical barrier. It simply is something that things run into and can't get through. That is, a lot of those things can't get through. So it's just a mechanical barrier to begin with, but more than just a mechanical barrier, like I said a few minutes ago, secretions of the skin make it acidic, and that makes up the so-called acid mantle, and that acidity inhibits the growth of bacteria, makes it harder for them to reproduce, so that keeps them in check. And also sebum, which is body oil, we talked about it in a different chapter, that contains bactericidal chemicals, things that kill bacteria. The keratin, which is a major protein giving the skin its toughness, is also resistant against chemicals that can hurt you. It's not just living things that can hurt you. It's various other things, just molecules and various kinds of chemicals that could hurt you otherwise. But the skin is pretty resistant against those because of keratin, the major protein in our skin. Intact mucous membranes, which are not the epidermis, but the linings of the vagina and the anus and the mouth, and or the openings of the body, basically. They not only produce the mucus, like I was talking about, that because of its stickiness traps things, but they also grow hairs in certain parts. You know, you have hairs in your nostrils that are a first line of defense because they trap out, they filter out or trap large things that are in the air you breathe. This makes it easier for them to be removed and it keeps them from going into the lungs where they could do a lot more damage. Cilia is just the plural of cilium, which means hair, but here cilia are not actually hairs. We're talking about cilia on individual cells lining the trachea. The trachea is not only mucus, so it produces mucus that sticks. That stuff that sticks to the mucus then gets swept away because cilia are not only little hair-like projections on the cells, they are moving back and forth like oars in a boat. And when they do that, the things that stick to the mucus get swept away upward, superiorly from your trachea into your pharynx, and you swallow this continuously, and that puts it into the stomach, which kills most things because the stomach has such a low pH, such a high acidity, that very few things can survive that environment. That's what the gastric juice is. The gastric juice is the stuff that the stomach produces. It does that for digestion of some foods. Not a very much digestion actually occurs in the stomach, but some does. Really, a major function of that acidity of that gastric juice, though, has nothing to do with digestion. It's just about destroying the things that you swallow that get caught in your pharynx and in your throat, or I mean in your trachea, swept up by those cilia. So that's the most because of the low pH, the stomach is the most inhospitable place on your body, and therefore most things don't make it past that. It's the perfect place to put things that could do you harm. There is also an acid mantle of the vagina, just like on the skin, and for the same reason. It inhibits growth of bacteria, because that's another major opening that could get into the body. The inside the vagina is really outside of the body, the same way that the throat is, but it makes an acid mantle for the same reason. And then we've already talked in the special senses chapter about lacrimation, which is crying or tear production. Lacrimal secretion or tears are not only about lubricating the eyes, as we've talked about, but they contain lysozyme, which is a protein acting as an enzyme that destroys invading microorganisms. Now, if we go on to the next slide, which is 9, this is the same table, but now we're looking at the second line of defense, which, as we've talked about in the previous slide, includes phagocytes, natural killer cells, and inflammatory response, or the inflammation. Phagocytes operate via phagocytosis, so when things that are there that are not part of you and therefore are a threat, the phagocytes will swallow them. Natural killer cells, as I already talked about, those recognize cells in you that are your cells, but they get recognized as abnormal cells, either because they have been infected by viruses or because they have become cancerous. And you don't want cancerous cells to split into two cells, because when a cell splits into two cells, those two cells are exact copies of the original, which means the two new cells will also be cancerous. This is how tumors start. So when a cell becomes cancerous, natural killer cells recognize that and usually kill it, which is why cancer is much more rare than it would be without these natural killer cells. Inflammatory response, like I said, is invoked when there is some sort of damage or infection in the body, and we'll talk about the specifics of that when we get to a different slide. But that's all second line of defense. Along with first line of defense, that makes up the innate or nonspecific body defenses. Antimicrobial chemicals are not cells of the second line of defense, but specific molecules that work. And complement, I don't want to get too deeply into complement, but complement is a collection of proteins that are carried around in the blood. They are so-called plasma proteins, because they're not inside the blood cells, they're inside the plasma, which is outside of it's the extracellular matrix of the blood, the plasma is, and that includes various kinds of proteins for various things, but the complement is important for lysing or splitting open microorganisms, cells that are invaders. If they get lysed or split open, that will kill them, and that, of course, is going to protect you. Interferons are signal molecules. They get released by cells that got infected by a virus. So these are interferons are released by your own cells, but only when those cells of you get infected by a virus. And that sends a signal to the rest of the body that this invasion has taken place, and therefore various steps are taken to kill whatever it is that's trying to invade you. And then we have fluids, various kinds, with an acidic pH, a low pH. And like I said before, this inhibits bacterial growth. It makes them harder to reproduce, and that allows it, when you have a fewer number of bacteria, you have an easier job at killing them. Fever, once again, it is an elevation in body temperature in response to some sort of something going wrong in your body. They're called, these things that cause fevers are called pyrogens. The pyro means fire or heat, like a pyromaniac, for instance. In fact, another name for fever is pyrexia, P-Y-R-E-X-I-A. But things that cause fevers are called pyrogens, and so they bring about the fever as a way of protecting you. And by the way, medicines that you can take to reduce fever are therefore called antipyretics. Aspirin is an example of an antipyretic. Anyway, let's go on to 11. This one, this slide is about, it's a flow chart, as you see, that represents the complexity of the inflammatory response or inflammation. So you start out with some sort of injurious agents, and you notice the example here, and this is just one of many ways that this could be invoked, but this guy cut himself on this glass of tube, or this piece of glass tubing. So whatever the cause, the injurious cause, the things that causes injury is, cells get damaged, including the cells that line the blood vessels, including capillaries. So it's pretty easy to damage capillary cells because they are basically running through everywhere in the body. They're so small. And when they get damaged, there are proteins in the blood that realize this has happened, because before the injury takes place, what's in the blood doesn't get exposed to anything other than the cells that form the lining of the vessels. When you cut yourself, you're breaking that lining. So now the things that are in the bloodstream are suddenly exposed to things other than just the cells lining the vessel. And that's what causes the inflammatory response. That's what the signal is. That's what the original signal is. And the response is that cells in the blood release special kinds of chemical signals like kinins and histamine and others. But these have various effects. And so notice that one of the major effects, that these red little dots represent various kinds of signal molecules released in response to injury. But some of the effects include dilation of blood vessels. And one word that that refers to that is vasodilation, V-A-S-O-D-I-L-A-T-I-O-N. Vaso, the vaso part of that word simply means vessel. So vasodilation is an increase in the diameter of blood vessels. And the reason that works well is because opening up the blood vessel in that affected region, wherever you got injured, brings more blood to that area, including all the things that are going to help you deal with this injury. So that's vasodilation, and it makes it easier for blood to flow into the area, and that's responsible, the fact that more blood is going into that affected area, that inflamed area, that's responsible for two of the so-called four cardinal signs of inflammation. You can tell that inflammation has occurred because there are four things that happen: redness, heat, pain, and swelling. Well, the redness and heat are both explained by the increased flow of blood. Blood itself is red, and when more blood flows to that area, it's going to make that area of the body more red, because you see through the skin, you're seeing the blood. But blood is a material, it's a fluid, but it's a material, and all materials contain heat energy. So if you, blood everywhere in the body is carrying heat. Heat is just the energy of the motion of the particles. But if you suddenly transport a lot more blood to an area because of this dilation, then you're delivering more heat that from the core of your body to wherever it is that is being inflamed. So that explains the heat as well. Now, this increase in heat, like I said earlier when I was talking about fever, which is slightly different, an increase in heat, though, speeds everything up chemically. All the chemical reactions, the metabolic rate of the tissues, in other words, increases, and this makes things happen more efficiently. Now, meanwhile, another effect of these things that get released as chemical signals is that the blood capillaries become more leaky. They're always leaky, like I was talking about on the first slide. They're always leaky to an extent, but in response to the inflammatory response, they become a lot more leaky just in that affected area. And so this allows for things to leave the bloodstream and get put into direct contact with the cells in that injured area. That's why edema is happening here. The fluid is leaking out of the blood stream and collecting in the affected area. So this is responsible for the other two cardinal signs of inflammation. Swelling occurs because the swelling is just the accumulation of the fluid that's coming out of those leaky blood vessels. And pain results because as that swelling gets worse and worse, it creates pressure that pushes directly on free nerve endings that cause the sensation of pain. And so the more painful this gets, the more unlikely it is that you're going to keep moving this body part like you normally would. The pain tells you, quit using this part of the body right now. Just let it go and let it heal. So the pain, even though it's a nuisance, is protective in itself. It keeps us from further injuring the body part, and it allows us to leave it alone so that things can happen to heal it. Neutrophils are specific kinds of white blood cells. Monocytes are also specific kinds of white blood cells. So these are two of the five kinds of leukocytes or white blood cells. They get recruited basically when these chemical signals get released in inflammation, and they're always there, but they get told, now it's your time to go to this specific area of the body. They leave the bloodstream and enter the affected area, and they do their various specific jobs to deal with whatever it is that's, you know, when you get cut, it's not just the physical damage. There are bacteria everywhere, including on, for instance, the glass that cut this guy. So this is a major way that you can get infected with bacteria. Therefore, you need to have these white blood cells delivered to that affected area quickly so that they can protect you. Now, these two boxes that are coming off of this middle line are all about hemostasis. Hemostasis is H-E-M-O-S-T-A-S-I-S. Stasis means staying, and hemo means blood. So hemostasis is another name for the stoppage of bleeding. When bleeding occurs, obviously, it's not good to lose blood, so the body needs to have something on hand, a process on hand, that it can invoke to stop the bleeding. Well, that stoppage of bleeding is called hemostasis, which is why an instrument that clamps on a blood vessel in surgery to stop bleeding is called a hemostat. But anyway, there's chemical hemostasis that occurs naturally in the body in response to this cell damage. And that involves various, it's very complex chemically, and we're not going to get into the complexity of it, but it involves various proteins that are there already circulating in the blood as part of the plasma, but when they get the signal, they change their chemical nature and start clumping together, forming clotting. Okay, now let's look at this inflammatory response in a different slide. We're on slide 12 now, and you can see now that the injury is caused, doesn't matter what the cause is, but this specific case is a little pin that's being that's puncturing through the mechanical barrier of the skin, and it's damaging cells that line capillaries, and we see a capillary down here in, this is really shown out of proportion, this is huge, it's not really that big, it's just a close-up. But anyway, when the damage occurs, those chemical signals that we were talking about in the flowchart before have one of their functions is to cause what's called chemotaxis. Now, taxis is a word that means movement. It's the same spelling as the plural of taxi. Taxis is T-A-X-I-S, but taxis, a different pronunciation, is a word that means movement. That's why their taxis are called that, because they move things around. But chemotaxis refers to movement of something toward a specific chemical. And that's one of the jobs of these chemical signals that get released in the affected area. They basically are attracting certain kinds of cells from the bloodstream to leave the bloodstream and go toward the affected area. So we can see neutrophils here in the bloodstream already. These are one of the five kinds of white blood cells. And they're already there. But they're just not doing anything under normal situations. When they get the signal, they leave the bloodstream. And they do that by squeezing between the cells that make the lining of the capillary. They're able to do this because they're attracted to the chemical signals released at the site of injury. But anyway, that exiting or the leaving of the neutrophils from the capillary out of the bloodstream is called diapedesis. Ped means walk, just like in pedestrian. And dia means across or through, like diameter is through the center of a circle. Diapedesis means walking through or leaving the bloodstream through the wall. Once those neutrophils are outside of the bloodstream and in direct contact with the injured area, then they can do their job of engulfing any invading bacteria. That's what these rod-shaped things are. They are bacteria. Well, we can see that was a cartoon, but in slide 13, we can see a macrophage, which is a phagocytic cell, engulfing several different bacteria. Each one of these little red bars is one bacterium. So the bacteria have multiplied, and to keep that in check, macrophages are going to swallow many of them, and once they're engulfed completely, this is one macrophage wrapping its plasma membrane around this group of bacteria. When it comes all the way around and closes off, then those bacteria will be safely inside the macrophage and they will be destroyed by that macrophage. Now 14, and we're looking at a cartoon again, obviously, but this really just shows you the steps of phagocytosis specifically for the purpose of immunity, for protecting you. So whatever it is that is a foreign body, that's called that is could be either a whole cell, like a bacterium, or it could even just be a particle of a cell. But it shouldn't be there is the main thing. So the phagocyte, which is the cell in purple here, that's the cell of your own body, will engulf it by phagocytosis. It will wrap its plasma membrane around, seal it off, and then that forms a vesicle. In this case, a phagocytic vesicle, or a phagosome. That's just another name for it. Some means body. Phago means eat. So once the phagosome is formed, that includes the potentially dangerous stuff, then that phagosome, which is one kind of vesicle, fuses with a lysosome, which is a different kind of vesicle already inside the cell. They're both made of the membrane material that surrounds these two vesicles are made of the same stuff, so they fuse together. But the lysosome includes originally enzymes, hydrolase enzymes, as they're called, that can break apart the molecules making up the dangerous stuff in green. And so when the phagosome and the lysosome fuse together, that mixes the enzymes with the things that need to be digested or broken apart to render them harmless. And once that happens, there's nothing that can hurt you anymore, and these raw materials that they used to be made of can be exocytosed, which is exocytosis, to spill it out of a different part of that same phagocyte. And this stuff is not going to hurt you anymore, and actually could be used as raw materials for building good materials within your body. So, you know, it's all made of the same stuff, basically. All organisms are made out of the same kinds of macromolecules. That means when you break this invader down into macromolecules, you can use those macromolecules to build your own stuff. Now to 15. And in 15, we're looking at one use of antibodies. Antibodies, like I said before, are proteins produced by immune cells. And they're Y-shaped proteins. This is one antibody, this is another antibody. And each of these tips of the Y is really the business end of the antibody, because that has a specific shape that allows it to bind to a specific thing that it recognizes. Well, in this case of use of antibodies, what you see here is complement proteins. We talked about complement before. It was back in when I was discussing the parts of that table. But the use of this in this case is that the antibodies recognize the surface of this invading cell. And they recognize it by binding to it. They have the right shape to bind to it. And when they recognize by binding to this cell that it's not a cell that should be there, this is a bacterial cell that's invading you, then the purple thing, which is a protein, gets embedded into the membrane of the invading cell. And this happens over and over. Several different proteins are embedded until they form a cylinder, which is a hollow cylinder. They basically form a pore. And so this whole thing is called a membrane attack complex, because it's attacking the membrane of the thing that is attacking you. The cell has its own membrane, but it's attacking you. So what your immune system does is attack the membrane of that invading cell. It's a membrane attack complex, or MAC. And what the MAC is, once it's fully installed, is really just a hole in the cell's membrane through which water can flow. And when water rushes into the cell, because it's now full of these holes, that will the buildup of pressure will explode this invading cell, and that will, of course, make it harmless to you. Okay, now to 16, let's talk about marrow, which I mentioned early on in this chapter. There's two kinds of marrow that are in the interior, the hollow interior of bones, red marrow and yellow marrow. The yellow marrow is really just an accumulation of fat, so that's not what we're talking about here. The red marrow, though, is where all of the formed elements of blood get created. And I talked about this in the blood chapter already. The formed elements, remember, include not only all six of the types of blood cells, red blood cells and five different kinds of white blood cells, but also cells that break apart into what will eventually be platelets. All of those things, those seven things, make up the formed elements of blood, the cellular component of blood. And they all start out as the same kind of cell, which are stem cells making up the red bone marrow. Those are the hematopoietic stem cells that I talked about in the other chapter. And when a stem cell splits into two cells, one of those two cells will hang around and replace the stem cell that split, and the other one will then develop into any of several things. That's what makes it a stem cell. It can develop into several different kinds of cells, including all of the blood cells. Well, here we're focusing on just one of the kinds of blood cells, lymphocytes. And lymphocytes are a specific kind of white blood cell. So when a lymphocyte is created from a stem cell, it's the so-called naive lymphocyte. A naive lymphocyte gets that name because it has not yet been exposed to the specific thing that it will eventually recognize. So it's like a naive person who's never experienced something before. That's why they're called that. So they're immature. These get created in the red bone marrow. Well, there's two major categories of lymphocytes, T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes. There are actually more categories than that because there are subcategories of those, but those are the two main types that we'll talk about in this class. The T cells or T lymphocytes are called that because the T stands for thymus, like I said earlier. Those make their way from the marrow where they start out to the thymus, and they spend some time in the thymus maturing and being exposed to the specific thing that they will recognize. They are then released from the thymus and take up residence in the lymph nodes, which is, as I've talked about earlier, where a lot of things get recognized that are in the lymph that could do you harm. So the T lymphocytes, once they're mature, leave the thymus and go to lymph nodes. Well, the B cells don't go to the thymus, the B lymphocytes, as they're called. They go from the marrow directly to the nodes, and they don't go through this thymus stage. Okay, now, immunocompetent here, this word simply means that they have matured into their active form. But they can be immunocompetent and still naive if they have developed to maturity but still have not been exposed to their specific thing that they can recognize. And those things that they can recognize, those specific things, are the antigens I was talking about earlier. So antigens are foreign particles. They should not be in your body. Antibodies, which T and B cells both involve, those are proteins produced by your immune system, but they are produced so that they can recognize specific antigens. And this is, you know, when they are antigen activated or finally mature, that means that they are not only immunocompetent, but they now have been able to recognize their specific antigen. And so you are making millions of, not only millions of copies, millions of different kinds of antibodies, even though you don't have millions of genes and genes code for proteins and antibodies are proteins. You're able to make millions of different kinds because, unlike most genes, the genes for your antibodies can actually be scrambled. The DNA can be rearranged, so you can use the same gene thousands and thousands of different ways to make slightly different antibodies. These are being produced just randomly in your body all the time, whether there is an antigen that you've been exposed to or not. And so each different kind of antibody can recognize its own kind of antigen. And if you never get exposed to that antigen, then that antibody will just circulate in your blood and do nothing, along with millions of other kinds that are able to recognize their own kinds of antigens. But if you suddenly get exposed to an antigen and you already have an antibody that can recognize it because you randomly made it earlier, then that's what is going to tell your body, okay, make a hell of a lot of different copies of this particular kind of antibody because we have been exposed to that type of antigen. Therefore, let's make an army of antibodies to protect us against this kind of antigen. That's why vaccines work. We make a vaccine by inactivating whatever it is that can do you harm, like a virus. So we destroy it partially, so it can't cause the disease, but it still has the correct shape enough to act as an antigen. That's put into your bloodstream. It doesn't cause the disease, but the antigen, if you have the antibodies for it, will be recognized by those antibodies, and that will tell the body to make a huge army of just those kinds of antibodies. And that way, later on, if you are exposed to the virus that has not been inactivated, if you're infected, then you won't get symptoms of the disease because those antibodies will be on hand already to destroy those antigens. Okay, 17 kind of explains this. At the top here, you have free antigens. That's what these red things are. Now, an antigen can be an entire cell, or they can be just a piece of a molecule from a cell, or they could be a virus. A virus, remember, is not a cell, but it's some sort of molecular particle. That's what an antigen is, and it's foreign material. Well, here we have B cells. These purple things are B cells. And B cells produce antibodies, which are the Y-shaped proteins that you see here. They get produced inside the cell, but then they get put onto the surface of the cell. So they're pointing outward, as you see here. And the tips of the Ys are what give them their ability to recognize a specific shape. So there's different kinds of B cells because each B cell will have its own kind of antibody. The green antibody, the purple one, and the blue one here all have different shapes. So they all recognize only their own kind of antigen. And that's why you can have millions of different kinds of antigens circulating in your blood, just a single cell or a tiny amount of cells of each type. But then when you get exposed to an antigen that's the right type for one of your B cells to recognize, like this one right here is recognizing this one because it has the right shape. The green one and the blue one don't recognize this red antigen, but this purple one does. And so that is the signal that tells the body, okay, we need a lot more of this particular kind of B cell with this particular kind of antibodies. And that's what leads to the formation of a clone. A clone is a group of identical cells that get produced from one original cell. And so that's what happens. By being exposed, it tells the body, this is the particular kind of B cell that we need, so make a hell of a lot of those. That's the clone. Now, the clone, which is a group of identical cells, all able to produce this kind of antibody, lead to two kinds of cells being produced from them. Plasma cells are B cells that produce this kind, specific kind of antibody, but fully secrete the antibody. So the antibodies are no longer connected to the cell. They get secreted out of the cell, and they therefore are part of the blood plasma. So you have antibodies, which are not cells. They're just proteins. These are circulating in the plasma, ready to do the work of recognizing a particular kind of antigen, like this red thing. Some of those cells from the clone, though, develop into what are called memory B cells, which really are the same thing. It's the same antibody being produced, but the antibody stays on the surface of these cells. And this is what gives you, these persist. They reproduce every once in a while, so you always have these living memory B cells carrying this particular kind of antibody in your blood, which is why a vaccine can last for a lifetime or at least very many years, because you have these memory B cells carrying the particular kind of antibodies, keeping them in the blood. So that's all primary response. This is the first time you get infected or exposed to the antigen. And if you survive that, In other words, if the antigen doesn't get a foothold and kill you, then if you're exposed later to the same kind of antigen, you'll already have this full army on hand that will not let it get a foothold. And this is why, as long as you survive the initial attack, the primary response, like getting a cold, for instance, if you survive getting that cold, you're never going to get the same kind of cold again caused by the same kind of virus, because you'll have antibodies on hand for the secondary response. Now, some people get a cold every year, but it's a different cold caused by a different virus. The fact that you made it through one cold, though, gives you immunity against the virus that caused that particular kind of cold, and similarly for other viral attacks. Now on to 18. Humoral immunity that you see listed at the top refers to immunity involving a humor or a fluid. Blood is a humor. That's what that word means. Humor doesn't mean funniness here. It means a fluid. So there is humoral immunity involving the blood, like we were just talking about. The antibodies are in part of the blood. But there's two aspects of humoral immunity, active and passive. So let's look at active first. For each of these two, though, notice that there's naturally acquired and artificially acquired. Naturally acquired active humoral immunity refers to becoming naturally exposed to whatever the pathogen is. Okay, so like for instance, you get the cold virus. That's why it's naturally acquired. It's just in the normal course of living, you get exposed to this thing. And that's why it's called active. You are active. Active actually involves the pathogen itself. So you can be naturally you can naturally acquire the immunity if you are actually exposed to the full pathogen, or you can artificially get exposed to it intentionally. In other words, with a vaccine, that involves either dead or misshapen pathogens, so that they don't actually give you the disease, but they do inspire the same kind of active immunity. So both naturally and artificially acquired active immunity involves the pathogen itself. On the other hand, you can get passive immunity, which makes it the reason it's passive is because you're not actually being exposed to the pathogen, even though you're getting immunity against that pathogen. The natural acquisition or naturally acquired passive immunity involves getting antibodies from your mother when you're a fetus. So this involves the placenta, which is kind of it's an unusual organ because it's kind of half the property of the mother and half the property of the developing fetus. It's where the fetus and the mother come together as two bodies, really. It's where their blood mixes. And so antibodies that are already in the mother's blood, because she already was exposed to something, those can get passed to the fetus, even though the fetus has never been exposed to that thing, and therefore can be born with immunity to certain things. Same thing with milk. Antibodies can be passed into to the baby when the baby nurses. Now, normally, those antibodies, which are proteins, would be destroyed by the digestive system. But in infants, they have a leaky intestine, so some of them do get destroyed, but some of those antibodies don't get broken into individual bits, and the whole protein or whole antibody gets put into the body of the infant. That's natural acquisition. You can artificially acquire passively by having antibodies from some other person that are produced by that person's body be injected into another person. So this is not the same as a vaccine, which injects the pathogen and allows your own body to produce its own antibodies. You could also inject antibodies from a person into another person so that they have those antibodies like they created them on their own. They just didn't create them on their own. They got them from somewhere else. That's why it's passive. 19, this is just a three-dimensional picture at a microscopic scale of a of an antibody. This is just to show you that they actually do have this kind of Y shape. It's not just a cartoon. And so at the tip of the two diagonal parts of the Y are identical places. So there's two different binding places. They're identical to each other, though. And this antibody can recognize just the right kind of antigen to fit into that shape there. That's why you need millions of different kinds of antibodies, because there's millions of different kinds of antigens that you need to be able to recognize. Now, it's easier to look at an antibody in cartoon form, as we see in slide 20. So this is the same Y shape. And the C here stands for constant. This is a protein, and proteins are made up of amino acids. So the whole thing is a string of amino acids. But the constant region is the same sequence of amino acids for all antibodies, even though all antibodies, the antibodies are different in that they recognize different things. All antibodies share this constant part, though. That's the same sequence of amino acids. The V is the variable part, and that's why this is the business end. The variable part gives this part of the antibody a specific shape, and that's what allows it to recognize just a specific kind of antigen. And this is why you need different kinds of antibodies, because each one will have a different variable region. Okay, now to 21. Another flowchart to look at. You have an antigen, some foreign material in your body, and assuming you already have an antibody that you made that can recognize that antigen, then there will be a temporary binding or a binding of that antigen to the antibody. This is another example, by the way, of a ligand binding to a protein. Well, when that happens, that causes a shape change, and that causes things to happen that wouldn't happen otherwise. In other words, the antibody causes things to happen only when it binds to the antigen that it is specific for. And when that happens, various things can occur. For instance, you have neutralization. That means simply making the invading pathogen, whatever it is, that's this yellowish thing here, unable to do any damage. Several different antibodies of the same type are recognizing the surface of this antigen, and by all of them binding to it at once, it basically shrouds it or covers it with antibodies, making it unable to interact with the cells of the body and do you harm. That's neutralization. Agglutination refers to clumping together. And you can see this happening, for instance, on cells, blood cells that are foreign blood cells. This is why transfusion of the wrong blood type can be so dangerous. Antibodies in that person's body recognize these cells as foreign cells, and they all stick together. The antibodies stick together on one end and stick to the red blood cells on the other end, and this clumps the red blood cells together. That's what's agglutination. Precipitation refers to falling. A precipice gets its name because it's a cliff that you can fall off of. And precipitation, like rain, is called that because it falls from the sky. Well, in chemical solutions, solutes are dissolved in that solvent, making up the solution. But certain things can happen to precipitate the solute. That means they fall out of solution and collect as solids in the bottom, if it were a beaker, for instance. This is another thing that antibodies can do. So these antigens, which were soluble, they were solutes in the blood originally, they get connected to these antibodies that are in the blood, and that causes the whole complex to precipitate out of solution, which makes it less likely that it's going to do you harm. So these are all protective devices. All of these things, by the way, notice, bring about phagocytosis. So cells that are phagocytic recognize that these things are happening. They recognize these big complexes, and they start engulfing them so that they can get them out of the system. On the other hand, another major effect of antibodies binding to antigens is to activate the complement system that we talked about earlier, forming these pore complexes. And so this is not new information, it's just another way that antibodies work. They embed these proteins into the membrane of the invading cell, and that causes cell lysis explosion. Both the complement system and all of these other antibody effects just the complement enhances, in addition to phagocytosis, inflammation. So the inflammation is what we discussed about before with the redness, the pain, the swelling, and the heat. That involves release of chemicals, and a major chemical in that inflammatory response is histamine. Histamine is working kind of like a hormone, only it's working locally. It doesn't get broadcast all the way through the body like a hormone does. It gets released just locally at the site of injury, and it brings about all various things in the inflammatory response that we looked at earlier. But this histamine, since it leads to inflammation, this is why in people that are allergic, for instance, and abnormally make an abnormal amount of histamine, or make it when there isn't really a dangerous thing happening in the body, that's why they take drugs called antihistamines to undo the effect of the histamine, to reduce the inflammation. That is the chapter.